Welcome to Bridge the Gap with hosts Lucas McCurdy and Joshua Crisp, a podcast dedicated to informing, educating, and influencing the future of housing and services for seniors. Powered by Markentum.
Welcome to another episode of Bridge the Gap podcast. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Joshua Crisp, and we have got an excellent guest on today. Super excited to welcome Ryan Frederick, founder and CEO of Senior Living 360. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Excellent, excellent. So I had this morning the fortune of being able to hear your keynote speech at the EFA show here in Savannah, Georgia. And it brought forth a lot of topics that our regular listeners will really resonate with, because we talk a lot about environments, a lot about multi-generational living. We talk a lot about senior technology, all the points that you hit today. And so I'm really excited about this conversation, because Josh is kind of my first window entry into those topics, because I just had never really discussed them before. And so to hear you two guys kind of rap about it, I'm very, very excited about that. Give us just a little bit of background and an introduction to who you are.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for having me. So I've been in, my background's been in senior living. As I mentioned, my talk this morning was in business school in Silicon Valley, and then about a decade ago sort of left. Okay. Initially by living in a retirement community for about a month in Atlanta, which is a host of stories for another time, and had worked in on the private equity side and then on the operating side with Ericsson before starting Smart Living 360. And so my point of view in this, and Josh, you know, I've talked about it, is I think there's some great things that senior living does today, but a lot of what we do has been anchored on things that just have happened over the last number of decades, where we've made things largely defined by age. Hmm. And so I think there are opportunities to provide vibrant living environments that help people thrive, that can be, in essence, ageless, where you can focus on creating community, but through building design, through sense of community, through coordinating services, you can allow people of different generations to live together the way we used to, facilitate this organic sort of natural community, and help people, you know, live well in this era of longevity. So it's really, as I mentioned this morning, it's an opportunity for the influence of good design to capture a much broader market than senior living does today.
So, Ryan, you know, I had the opportunity to meet you by phone back in the fall when I was just launching a new company focused on multi-generational, more affordable options. And you were a wealth of knowledge to me. The folks that introduced us was like, you got to talk with Ryan. And I actually missed the keynote this morning. So we got to hear more about it. Yes. We got to hear more about it, because the folks around here are buzzing. But I loved a couple of the points you even just made. I think one of the misconceptions is that even though, like, multi-generational or intergenerational, whatever terms you wanted to use, that kind of you and I have discussed that we're talking about here a little bit today, people think it's a little bit radical, it's out of the box. But then I also heard you just say, and we've talked about this, some of this is not new. It's kind of how housing used to be and how people used to view relationships and caring for your own, and not basing design or how we cared for people based on age and acuity and segregation. So tell me a little bit about your perspective on that and some of the things that you're drawing from history to kind of pave the way for the future.
Yeah, great question. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, arguably too much. And I mentioned this in the talk this morning, which you missed. And that is that...
rub it in.
Yeah. You know, you look at continuing care retirement communities, for example. When they started, what happened was people were part of faith-based communities, their church, and they were looking for care, like a plan, as they got older, and they were older, and they basically gave whatever they had, whether it was a lot or very little, to their church, and the church made the promise to look after them.
Sure.
And it wasn't professional people at the church, it was volunteers, it was a network, it was a village. Mm-hmm. That's how it happened.
Sure.
And that evolved now into an industry, mm-hmm. which is an important industry, but it's changed things now, where it's become professionalized,
sure.
where it's professional caregivers, where it is age-restricted, sure. and so forth. It's sort of shifted the ethos, mm-hmm. and it's an important component. There are real care needs. But as a result, we've taken things away from our communities.
Sure.
It's meant for people sometimes that live in these environments. The sense of purpose is not necessarily encouraged or the way it could be.
Yeah.
You know, you're in some ways being served as opposed to serving. And there's certain, of course, times in your lifespan where it's harder to serve. But the nexus of conversation is more around sort of being served in a number of these different environments.
Sure.
And it's and you look at it, the same has happened with the way assisted living has evolved and skilled nursing. It's this, we didn't get there overnight.
Sure.
But one thing led to another, and we just find ourselves where we have a plethora of age-restricted options, silos, ghettos, even people might say, of seniors.
Yeah.
And we haven't done as much to date about creating attractive alternatives that define it differently. And yet, when you talk to, when you talk to people in these environments or not in the environments yet, they don't necessarily say that their number one dream in life is to be around just older people.
Sure.
So I think that we're at the moment a little bit out of step, or the senior living is out of step with what at least the next generation is going to be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even before when you factor in the affordability concerns,
sure,
which makes some of the models today, I think, more challenging in that regard as well.
Yeah, well, you touched on so many great points there. But one of the things, you know, that whole care community, and you mentioned the church. I think that is, I mean, how culture has really changed. And you think of even how reimbursement models has changed. If you look at back at like the turn of the century, last century, I mean, the community was caring for and rallying. And like you said, people were giving to their churches and things like that later on. And now I think, and you know, you could talk politics here a little as well, but we've almost delegated the role to caring for older people to the government. And it's obviously become an expensive kind of crisis. So it's interesting to see, you know, in some of the communities, if you probably attest to, with strong partnerships with the church, with the greater community, how much when people come together, how much your cost of that care lowers. So I think that is one of kind of the secret ingredients in the secret sauce to the future when we start talking about affordability, because that seems to be what's on everybody's mind. You and I have talked a lot about this, Lucas. You may have some insights on this as well, Ryan. We'd love to talk with you on how do you think, like, what are some of the secret ingredients, how we're going to keep senior living affordable for this group of seniors in the next generation that not only have a different set of preferences, but they don't have the assets necessarily that our grandparents had. So
what I, Joshua, the way I describe it to some people is the future of senior housing is not senior housing.
Sure.
And what I mean by that is you can't get an affordable product. It's not possible with how it's done today.
Sure.
It's one thing if the construction costs are higher, which is what they are, but the biggest driver really are your operating costs.
Sure.
So you have situations where just the sheer labor that's involved and where that's headed, it's, and especially as people want more dining venues and different services, it's going to get harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the key is exactly what you said, Josh, which is we got to find a way to actually empower people that live in these environments, that are part of the neighborhoods, become more involved. And we say, you know, you mentioned we've delegated to the government. The reality is a lot of it has been pushed on different families, but where things are shifted from our healthcare system, you're going to see more and more hospitals, health systems that are incented to actually have people not come to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So that means more and more is going to have to be relied upon in the communities.
Sure.
Right now, we don't necessarily have the social capital in some of these communities to support that. We also don't necessarily have the building models to support it. So it's going to be a new frontier as this plays out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is, I see it sometimes as flipping the model upside down.
Sure.
Where instead of people being served, it's about empowerment.
Yeah. So if there are obviously senior housing developers, there's going to be owners, operators, there's going to be consumers listening to this. But speak to those owners and operators for a minute who may be hearing this, and they've been hearing this message repeated now as more people are talking about these kind of things, and you saying senior housing is going to kind of flip upside down and the affordability is not possible. So how are they going to stay relevant, and how can they use their existing model to be relevant in the future. So if you're talking strategically over the next 5 to 10 years to an operator right now that has communities, how can they stay relevant?
Well, I think what you're going to find is for high quality operators with good capital partners, good markets, they're going to do fine. Mm-hmm. And but what they're going to do fine is they're going to be living in this 10% of the market size. I mentioned this morning, you know, broad numbers, about 10% of people 75 and older are in some form of private pay senior housing. Mm-hmm. So the blue ocean is the 90% that aren't in that market. And actually that number has been gradually going down over time.
Sure.
So for groups that are in that marketplace and they do a really good job, there is plenty of wealth. Mm-hmm. It continues to be wealth creation that I think can do well there. Mm-hmm. But it does neglect this larger opportunity.
So how does that, and this may be putting you on the spot, but and I don't even know if any of us know the answers to this, but, you know, when you go into a market, you typically are ordering feasibility studies and doing third-party market work. And kind of we've all seen it. If you looked at all these market studies, no matter who's doing them, they're using the same formularies, and that's leading to an unmet demand. How is what you're talking about right now going to change that formulary? How are we going to have to start looking at this differently?
So we have interviewed quite a number of feasibility consultants.
Yes.
Because it all depends on what these underlying assumptions are.
Sure.
And around penetration rate, around affordability, and for our product with our first project in Rockville, Maryland, we're non-age restricted. We had people in their 90s, 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, families, millennials. It's a big range. Mm-hmm. And so the size that you capture of the older market is even lower potentially than we might find for a senior product. I think that's a great question, though. I think it's one that's going to evolve around mm-hmm. feasibility. You know, I think you're going to see some stuff in some of these markets where there's oversupply, mm-hmm. a testing of some of those assumptions. One of the key things that feasibility studies often miss is the psychographics. They tend to be driven on demographics,
sure.
age and income, mm-hmm. but they don't necessarily, well, how does Josh think? How's Lucas think? How's Ryan think? Mm-hmm. Those become key drivers in where you decide to live.
Sure.
And you can do that from a marketing outreach perspective. There are ways to understand by sort of thinking how you can group people. Mm-hmm. Feasibility studies haven't necessarily done that level of work so far, mm-hmm. but I would anticipate more thoughtful lenders and investors to want to do that extra level of work over time.
Sure.
So the guess is, oh wow, this sort of community is going to resonate with this group.
Yeah.
And here's why.
Yeah.
I just think they'll be more common.
So give us a little bit of insight behind the curtain, unveil it. You're obviously thinking this way, and you've got to be doing some of this. I'm going to call it psychoanalysis, but whatever you want to call it. How that seems like very labor-intensive. It seems like a lot of time spent maybe in the market, boots on the ground, understanding, because I'm assuming that kind of varies a little bit based on the part of the country you're working
in. It is. So there are actually our versions of Claritas, for example, that do break down the psychographics mm-hmm. of different geographies, and they have buckets up to, I think, about 30. So there are groups you can work with that are somewhat standardized for this, but we do find is when people visit the community or residents that are there, we do some thinking around what are the key drivers for this type of person? How can we make sure we tell our story best? How can their experience in the community best resonate? Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a sort of subtle grouping mm-hmm. that can happen, which is a little bit labor consuming,
sure.
but I wouldn't say terribly so.
Sure.
And particularly when you focus on the empowerment, you know, how with these brands and ours with Smart Living 360, how can we identify the people that want to make a community that we create extraordinary?
Sure.
Because ultimately, in our view, it becomes more about the people in the building and empowering them in this authentic community than is necessarily the people on our team. We're more catalysts.
Sure.
But it's really theirs. It's their keys.
Yeah. So explain to us in a community right now, either that you have or that you're working on, bring us into that world. What does it look like? What does it feel like for yeah. the people that will be living there, that will be working there?
Yeah. So the first community we have is a smaller one, more of a proof of concept. It's about 50 units in Rockville, Maryland. The others that we're pursuing right now are about 150 units. And so we see that as more of our prototypical size. We think, well, it's a lot of things, Josh. You know, I think that this idea of design sort of coupled with the culture is significant. So when you walk into a Smart Living 360 community, you see our lifestyle ambassador, they know you by name.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're a resident, when you come in as a prospective resident, we want to understand your story. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go run in and see an apartment.
Yeah.
We're going to take a moment. We're going to find out like what's important to you, like what you're looking to solve, mm-hmm. and how we could be partners in that. Now, some people may engage in that discussion more than others, mm-hmm. but that's why I mentioned this morning, mm-hmm. To Lucas's point, like we see housing as a foundational for helping people live, enhance their well-being. And that's so awesome. we get a sense to understand what that's like, and then we want to make sure that their experience is excellent, in the leasing process. And then if you are a resident, to fast forward to that point, engaging them in roles in which they can feel like they're part of the community.
Sure.
So that means that there's kind of clubs that people have started, sure. or gatherings that we've sort of lightly been a catalyst for. Mm-hmm. There's been situations like I talked about this morning where we've had families where there's been kids that have been tutored by older people, in the building, that's had a tangible benefit around learning French, as I mentioned this morning, but actually a very kind of intangible, softer but powerful point around mm-hmm. these connections,
yeah.
these social connections, this face-to-face piece that sometimes get lost. So it's a lot of things,
sure.
but I think what would be really important is when people come in, they sense it's more than a building.
Sure.
We do, we kind of bracket all of our activities into what we call connection, access, or simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of anchoring tagline is life to a better degree.
Okay.
So it's this idea that, hey, we'll help sort of turn on other things that you may be interested in. It's not just a place to hang your hat.
Sure. So a couple of different things. Obviously it's really exciting to build something from the ground up, create it. But there's this whole world Lucas and I spend a lot of time in where there's like a lot of older assets that, are aging, they need to be repositioned. So what are some practical things that people can ease into, I would say, future relevancy if they have a really old asset out there and they're trying to move into the future?
It's a great question. So, and I think there's a couple applications. You have applications in a senior housing environment, and they have applications, there are old assets that are not senior housing. And there's applications of both. So, in the senior housing one, you have a couple different options. I think you are seeing some situations where there's an opportunity to make that more of a healthcare-centric model.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some examples of that happening. I think there are some examples where if you can double down on the community aspect, it may not matter how big your unit is, mm-hmm. relatively. It may not matter if it has all the nicest amenities and features. It's like this idea that, hey, I am known, right? This is part of my tribe. I get this sense of connection. I think that can be a very powerful force mm-hmm. on the senior living side.
Mm-hmm.
On the non-senior living side, it's interesting. I think you see there's a lot of apartment buildings that are buildings and not communities.
Sure.
And as people are looking for different places to live, there's a pretty interesting opportunity there to get involved in older apartment buildings that may be well located, where you can provide some capital expenditure changes, but also change the ethos mm-hmm. that allows you to cater to a broader audience.
I love that. So Lucas, that's kind of the world that you work in a lot. Thoughts
yes.
on that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating because I think that this is going to be a huge opportunity on the horizon as people make these acquisitions, as they're trying to be competitive in the marketplace. And a lot of the things that both of you guys are saying, I know that occupancy is a big topic right now. And I mean, it would have to have a major impact on those types of tribes that are being built multi-generationally in these communities. It's got to help drive occupancy. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So I think what you're finding right now, if I put my investor hat on for a second, if you're only betting on millennials, you get concerned that they may marry, they may have kids, they may move, there may be other attractive buildings to go move to. So the churn rate can be pretty high in that mm-hmm. situation. As you look to other demographics and psychographics, people can stay there longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from an investor's perspective, the idea of someone moving in and having a stickiness to that is very powerful.
Yeah.
And if there's a stickiness as well as a referral base, like they have other friends in the community, see the benefits, I think that's powerful too. So I think you're going to see more and more people. That's why I mentioned it this morning at the talk. It's not senior living, it's environments for people that are aging. And that broadly defined, there's a lot of different ways to sort of solve that for people. And I think existing assets can be one way to get there as well.
So, Lucas, I could geek out talking to Ryan all day. We have a limited show here. Yes. I see Sarah, our production, showing us the clock here. But, you know, our podcast, Bridge the Gap, inform, educate, influence the senior housing industry. Ryan, it's awesome having you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for the work you've done for EFA today. Lucas, Ryan, anything closing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's great. It's going to add a lot of value back to our audience. And so just like we talk about in every show, we'll make sure that we connect to Ryan in the show notes so that people can ask you questions. I really hope that this does stir a healthy conversation about what is on the horizon and really help collaborate to make our industry even stronger by working together. And so just because our podcast is over, we don't want the conversation to end. So we'll make sure that we connect. Please ask your questions online. We'll engage with you. And we're just very grateful for your time. Josh, thank you for your time as well. It's been a healthy conversation that I got a lot out of personally. And so thank you for listening to another great episode of Bridge the Gap.
Josh and Lucas. Out.